Welcome to the Cycling Podcast Feminin, proudly brought to you by Shox Bone Conduction Headphones. This is Lionel here, and for the past few weeks, I've been using Shox headphones, the Open Run Pro 2 model to be precise, and I've been really impressed with the comfort and sound quality. They're very different to any headphones I've used before because nothing actually goes into your ear, and straight away I found this to be much more comfortable to wear, especially when exercising. When I've used conventional in-ear headphones on the turbo trainer or out running or riding on the trails, I find that they can get sweaty and slippery and sometimes fall out of the ear. In-ear headphones can also compromise your awareness of the sounds going on around you. Shox, on the other hand, give you great sound whether you're listening to music or your favourite podcast, such as the Cycling Podcast, but they don't block out what's going on around you. So how do they work? Well, Shox bone conduction technology means that they sit just behind the ear with the sound passing to the inner ear through the skull. It sounds a bit science fiction, doesn't it? And I was a little skeptical to start with, but it really works. There's a band that holds them securely in place, and then a little speaker that takes care of the bass, which gives you richness and depth of sound that you really want, especially when listening to music. Through that combination of bone conduction and air conduction, you get unmatched sound quality, even though there's nothing actually in your ear, which, as I say, feels a lot more comfortable to wear. Crucially, though, you can still hear a lot of what's going on around you, and yet somehow it doesn't compromise your enjoyment of what you're listening to. You feel connected with your environment and surroundings while still enjoying the podcast or music that you've chosen. There's even a model that works underwater, so if you're a swimmer, check out the Open Swim Pro. They're actually 30% off the Open Swim Pro model right now, meaning they're £135 instead of £169. And Cycling Podcast listeners can get £10 off any purchase with the discount code CYCLING10 at uk.shox.com. That's uk.shox.com. We'll put all the details in the show notes. Shox, redefining the sound of sports. Now it's over to Rose for the rest of the show.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast Femina.
Well, it's a bumper transfer edition of the Cycling Podcast Feminin here today. My name is Rose Manley, and well, I'm glad that there haven't been any big moves in or out of the Cycling Podcast team since last time we spoke. So I'm delighted to be joined by the Cycling Podcast's answer to Demi Vollering and Anna van der Breggen. That is Denny Gray.
Who's who, Rose?
And Orla Shenouy. Well, I have put a bit of thought into it. I didn't just throw it out there without thinking. I was saying that Orla, you'd be the Anna van der Breggen, you know,
okay,
one of the greatest of all time, kind of the OG. So many credentials under her belt, kind of, you know, been a bit quiet, you know, this season on the podcast, but making a big return now.
Few question marks whether she should still be in the game.
Tactical now.
Is she past her best?
The DS.
Should she bow out gracefully? Leave it to the young guns. All right, Rose, I get the picture.
And obviously the glamorous...
You know what you said about the transfers, by the way? I'm open to offers if anybody else, if anybody listening wants to poach me. The transfer window is still open.
Oh, would you? I gave you Anna van der Breggen, one of the greatest of all time.
Fair. Yeah,
come on.
Yeah. I'll take it.
What would you have been happy with? That's the difficult one.
Do you know what? Maybe I'm in one of those moods, Rose. I told you before we started, I was kept awake because my husband's snoring all night. I'm not very well slept. Maybe I'm just a bit cranky. I've not had my breakfast, even though it's 11 o'clock in the morning here. So maybe I should wind my neck in and look at that glass once again and notice that it's not half empty. No, it's half full. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Anna van der Breggen. We actually, before we even started recording, had a huge argument about how good chocolate orange is versus mint chocolate. But I'm not going to bring that up now. And, you know, Denny Gray, very similar in name to Demi Vollering.
True.
You know, I went for that because, you know, I thought...
not because of my talent on the bike or on the podcast, just because my name sounds similar.
No, the talent on the podcast, obviously, more of a newcomer than Anna van der Breggen. And I thought also, you might feel sometimes a bit embittered by your teammates kind of throwing a few punches into you sometimes. So it kind of makes sense. Goodness.
Yeah, I haven't felt very well supported by my team recently. But,
exactly.
But thankfully, I'm moving on next year.
Hang on a minute. We're both on the same side, however, of the chocolate orange mint chocolate debate. Oh. So there you go. We've got solidarity there, Danny, at least.
We have. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. It's still all those rumours about
when we get to that
team infighting are untrue.
Well, at least, you know, I know at the Cycling Podcast Christmas party, I can have a whole chocolate orange to myself while you old ladies enjoy your mint chocolates.
Honestly,
Terry's
chocolate orange are the most old lady Christmas chocolate there is. I feel like a family affair.
Not more than mint chocolate. Come on. Granny always has a box of mint chocolate, you know, where they have the variety of
different
mint chocolates.
Every granny has a chocolate orange. And can I just say, is there anything more childlike than taking the box of After Eights, shoving as many of those mothers into your mouth as you possibly can, and then leaving the wrapper in the box to fool your siblings?
Yes.
So they think there's loads of mints left and there aren't. Ha ha ha, they're all in your tummy.
That's something you do at your grandma's house, though, isn't it? That's the thing. That's where you do that. Oh, anyway, Anna van der Breggen would be a lot less argumentative, I think. She would, you know.
I mean, quite probably. I'll give you that.
Yeah. She would be giving the orders, though, probably. But, so we're going to be talking about transfers. When we do end up not talking about chocolates and Christmas chocolates, we will be talking about transfers. And we do also have a very mini feature, actually, that me and Denny collected actually at the Tour de France fam, if you can remember that far back, where we were speaking about why is Dutch cycling so good, or women's cycling, should I say, specifically, Dutch women's cycling so good, and, you know, maybe whether the tide is turning. So we spoke to, when we were out at the tour, we spoke to Iris Slappendael and some Dutch riders like Rianne Marcus and Misha Bredewold and Lorena Wiebes, and also some non-Dutchies to get the outside perspective, like Lizzie Dynan, who now we know is going to be doing her last season next year. But we'll be touching on that a little bit later. Well, I mean, we have been actually touching upon transfers all season long. It has been kind of weirdly probably as big a storyline, hasn't it, as the racing has been. And Denny, you gave a great analogy before we started recording, which was that it was like throwing all that, not just to steal your analogy and use it myself, but it was like throwing all the cards up and seeing where they land. But it has been crazy, isn't it, so far? And different to any season we've had previously, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, we were speculating about this off air, but I think we all agreed that this seems like the biggest shakeup in women's cycling in terms of transfers we've had that we can remember. Huge changes. And we've already reflected on the fact that, of course, you know, Damie Vollering's move to FTJ Suez will have massive ramifications across women's cycling and how the GC race is played out. But there just seems so many transfers to unpick, almost it's difficult to know where to start, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there you go. I mean, that's exactly right. It's difficult to know where to start. But let's start with our kind of, which transfer do we think has most piqued our interest? Orla, I'm going to come to you. You get first dibs. You're like, as the Anna van der Breggen of the team, you get first dibs on, you know, which one you think is the most interesting transfer, what you're most excited to see.
Well, it's actually very telling and appropriate that you have named me the Anna van der Breggen, Anna van der Ring Squirrel,
yes,
we called her from us, of this episode, because my pick isn't actually a transfer at all. It is a signing, and that is Anna van der Breggen coming out of retirement, because I feel like we learned about this earlier in the season and we were all surprised by it at the time. And it's been almost a footnote and a subheading of conversations since then. But now when we sit down and look at the composition of the teams and what their racing is likely to be for next season, it just struck me that actually Anna van der Breggen's return to racing is fascinating for so many reasons. And I'm really, really excited to see what she can produce. Firstly, because obviously of her pedigree, and it's almost easy in the couple of seasons since she's gone into retirement to forget exactly what she's achieved, when we've had Annemiek van Vleuten going into retirement herself and Demi Vollering's emergence as the dominant stage racer. When we look at Olympic gold, worlds, and European and national championships, multiple classics, Flèche Wallonne for 7 consecutive years, let's not forget, Amstel gold, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, Tour of Flanders, four editions of the Giro d'Italia. I think already it's easy to forget the extent of her palmarès, but of course she retired before we had a Tour de France femme. And in the few years since she's retired, women's racing has moved on in leaps and bounds, it feels like. So that's why Anna van der Breggen coming back into the sport is going to be fascinating, because I feel like even the couple of editions of the Tour de France femme that we've had have signaled where we're at in women's racing, and where we're at is a very, very exciting time with strength and depth at the very top of the field that we didn't have when Anna was racing. And I just wonder whether the dominance that she left with, obviously she, I mean, it would be a surprise, I think, if she's going to come back under that level of dominance. But I think she'll be a really good litmus test of where women's racing has gone to in the couple of years since. But it's also the team that she's going back into, which is a team that she didn't leave. Of course, she was a sports director at SD Works since 2021. But she goes into an SD Works now as a racer without a Damie Vollering, for example. And let's not forget that she was Damie's DS. So she's going to know Damie's strengths and weaknesses possibly even better than any of her teammates will have done, because she will have sat in all of these management meetings discussing Damie's strengths and what her tactics should be and how they can compensate for any potential weaknesses that she might have. She will know Damie inside out in a way that maybe only Damie knows, which is going to be fascinating. But also, she's now going to come in alongside Lotta Kopecky. And this is a Lotta, of course, who has butted heads with Damie to be leader of that team. Where will Anna sit with that? Because Anna's not just coming back in for the paycheck. She's coming in to win races. And she has said that she's not expecting to win immediately, which I think is, you know, a sensible approach to have, because we will all be jumping on her first race results as indicative of whatever it might not be a sign of. So it takes that pressure off forever so slightly, but it won't stop us, of course. But she will ultimately be competing in some way or other with Lotta for leadership of that team. So I think Anna van der Breggen's return is going to be fascinating, and it's one I'm really, really excited about because of her, because of what she brings to racing, because of the dynamics of the team, and because of what it will tell us of the wider state about women's racing.
I think that's key, isn't it? I think it's not just about the how women's racing has changed, or, you know, how it's got stronger, but in a way, the way that these big races are raced is so different to what Anna van der Breggen used to do. I mean, she used to win always almost like in a time trial kind of mode, didn't she? She would kind of go off on her own and solo to some, you know, magnificent victory, put her head down and just go for it. But that's kind of, even on the high mountains now, you know, just looking at the Tour de France Femme on Alpe d'Huez this year, that's not how it is now. You have to be a little bit more fighting against your rivals, whereas I think women's cycling used to be on those high mountain passes, used to be more about what your own personal output, power output could be on those kind of climbs. So it'd be really interesting to see if she can fit back into actually a totally different mode of racing as well. So it would be so interesting. And SD Works have, Denny, I know, you know, you've noticed this as well, kind of put all their eggs in that Anna van der Breggen, Lotta Kopecky basket, haven't they, a bit? Because they haven't been bringing in a load of other big names.
No, they haven't brought in any big names, and they haven't just lost Damie Vollering. They have lost some other big riders. They've lost Marlon Reusser to Movistar, Niamh Fisher-Black to Lidl Trek. Anna Shackley had to retire. She was a, you know, great young talent. Christine Amargaris has retired. And their replacements, you would argue, are more kind of moneyball, kind of calculated risks in some ways. It feels like SD Works' big priority was to secure the long-term contracts of Lotta Kopecky and Lorena Wiebes. And that's where their money's gone. And they've had to be a lot more savvy about the rest, you know, filling the rest of their roster. So some of the riders coming in are, I guess, a little bit like Anna van der Breggen, really. A little bit untested, at least recently. They've got Skyler Schneider, who used to ride for the team, but has been riding crits in the US for a while. They've got Steffi Haberlin, a mountain biker who's, you know, shown a lot of talent, came fifth on the final stage at the Tour de Suisse, but is really unproven on the road. So I think we'll be seeing a very different SD Works team next season as a result. They will have their big stars, minus Damie Vollering, but with Anna van der Breggen. But behind them, I guess that leaves a big question mark about their strength and depth.
Well, let's move on to another transfer. Denny, what's your kind of your pick of what you're most excited about? Most... Can it top the return of a once in a generation rider?
Maybe I should go for another kind of once in a generation rider then, Pauline Ferrand-Prevot, because Anna van der Breggen, whilst Ferrand-Prevot hasn't been out of cycling, she's been out of road racing for a while, but is now joining Visma Lisa bike with the intention of winning the Tour de France Femmes in 2025. It adds another spice to the mix for GC racing next season. And, you know, she's another rider with an amazing track record. She is likely to be the out-and-out leader if she can prove herself next season at the Tour de France Femmes. Anna van der Breggen, we're not quite so sure, because will Lotte Kopecky want that leadership role in the Tour de France Femmes, for example? So she's kind of got a clear run if she can prove herself and readjust to the road. That is a potentially a big move for, for women's cycling generally. Generally, it's another big rider, another big name, another big GC contender that we'll be throwing into the mix next season. And that makes, you know, we've spoken about this a lot, but it just feels like there are so many teams, so many riders now who, when we sit back and think about next season, you know, there will be several names we pick out as potential winners of some of the biggest races. And I think we didn't see that last year. Last year, the conversation was all about who can beat Damy Vollering. You know, who will be the new rival now that Annemiek van Vleuten's retired? Whereas we've got a completely different picture now, thanks to transfers like this.
With Pauline as well, she'll be coming in with an awful lot of confidence, given the Olympic title that she picked up in the mountain biking in Paris. It feels like, from afar at least, that she has been hugely buoyed by that. And I think that she's coming back into road racing on her own terms, which is always exciting and probably quite frightening for rivals. And I love the extent of her ambition as well. You know, she's not coming in to see how she's going to get on back at road racing. She's coming in to win the Tour de France Femmes. She's gone as big as that. And also with Visma Lisa bike, bringing in the exceptional young talent, Marion Bunel, who was the Tour de France 11 year winner last year and completed her first Tour de France Femmes, getting a top 20 there and third in the white jersey competition for best young rider. She's got huge, huge potential as well. And having that French alliance between the two of them, I'm just really excited to see what Visma are going to do, because I think that's going to be a slightly different approach for them. And yeah, I think Pauline could be a really exciting prospect for next year.
It changes also what Visma Lisa bike are like as a team completely, doesn't it? They suddenly become a GC team when they actually haven't been. I mean, they've kind of mainly worked around Marianne Vos kind of stealing a win here and there, and kind of not, you know, Vos really doesn't ever need a team built around her to get those kind of results. She's kind of always just, you know, stolen as like an opportunist type role. And obviously they had Rhianna Marcus, who's was kind of time trial, and we thought that she would kind of craft herself, model herself into a kind of a major GC rider, but that kind of didn't quite happen. You know, she had some good results this year. Obviously, I picked her out as, you know, as having a lot of potential for the Tour de France Femmes, but didn't quite make it there. But obviously, she's going to Lidl-Trek, which, you know, that is a big, exciting move, and joining there also Niamh Fisher-Black, also going there from SD Works, because of the space of that has been created by what my pick as the most exciting transfer is, which is Elisa Longo-Borghini going to UAE ADQ. I think that's major. I know, Orla, it was a bit of a heartbreaker for you for Elisa Longo-Borghini to be leaving Lidl-Trek, and having been so key to the identity of that Trek team ever since it started. But I think it's exciting. For me, it's an exciting one because I think it's a bit of a risky move, really, for Elisa Longo-Borghini, because, you know, UAE ADQ, they're not a major player yet. They obviously have some fantastic riders, but, you know, she's going there, she's moving along there with Brody Chapman and Eleanor Backstead, both from Lidl-Trek as well. So she's kind of got a little her own, bringing a bit like, you know, when a football manager goes somewhere and takes his kind of backroom staff. It's a bit like that going to UAE ADQ. But I think it's a little bit risky because she obviously has said that she kind of wants to be you know, up there in the Ardennes Classics, and she wants to be winning the Tour de France Femme next year if she can. But when you have a team that hasn't got lots of results across the board in the season, I feel like there's almost going to be too much pressure on Elisa Longo Borghini to perform. You know, she'll need to perform at the Spring Classics and the Ardennes and the be a, you know, GC rider when the stage races comes along, you know, because looking at their results, their best results in the Spring Classics were, you know, third and fourth in Gent-Wevelgem and Dapana, both from Chiara Consoni, who is leaving next year. So she won't be there to get those results next year. And then apart from that, sixth at Amstel from Gasparini. So I kind of think that it's all going to fall on Elisa Longo Borghini too, as the Tour de France, as the Tour of Flanders champion. You know, next year they're going to need to have her racing the Tour of Flanders. She's going to be their best hope for the Ronde van Vlaanderen. She'll be their best hope for the Ardennes. She'll be the best hope for all of the GC races. So will it be too much pressure on her at a team like that?
I think she'll love it. I think yeah. She'll love that pressure, because with the pressure comes support as well. If she is their out and out lead rider, and as you say, she's bringing two key riders with her as well, I think that is a challenge she's going to love. I mean, even at Lidl Trek, she's always up there, you know, and she's always one of their main cards to play. And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't, but it never doesn't work because of, from what it looks like anyway, because of too much pressure or too much workload or whatever it might be. She's greedy. She's so hungry. She's one of these riders who just, I feel like you put her on a start line and that's it. She just wants to be up there in the mix, whether that's a win or not. She's gobbling up kilometres as greedily as she possibly can. I think she's going to love it. And I think, all things being equal, and if she stays well and healthy and injury free, this could be the making of her, absolutely. And yeah, I'm sad that she's leaving Lidl Trek, because I feel like that's been one of my little pet teams, and I've loved the dynamic between her and Lizzie in particular, and the personality that's brought to the team. But she brings that personality now to UAE, and I love the spreading out of our interest as well, because UAE haven't really been able to feature on our radar in the same way, and now we're able to talk about a different team being right in the mix. And we'll still be looking at Lidl Trek as being one of the key contenders. But I love that she is spreading our interest with a little bit more depth and texture and personality further across the board.
It is a long calendar though, isn't it? And we are seeing a lot of teams kind of delineating between, you know, these are kind of our GC people, and these are our sprinters, or these are our classics people. So, but I mean, I think that's good. I think obviously, you know, Elisa Longo Borghini is not going to go to a team where she thinks she can't get the results. So that's why I kind of like that it is a little bit of a risk. And obviously she is joining Silvia Persico and Erica Magnaldi there. Obviously both Italians, we know how, you know, united the, you know, Italian riders are when they're teammates on the national side. So, you know, I imagine that kind of goes a little bit of a way now, even in the UAE as a trade team. So I do think it will be really exciting. Obviously, you know, also defending that Giro title. I mean, that was such a fantastic moment this year. So she's going to want to push on, isn't she?
Yeah, and she was remarkably consistent this season. You know, she did actually was on top, in top shape during the Classics. She won Flanders. She was up there in the Ardennes Classics. She came third in the Vuelta, won the Giro, and then of course she had to pull out the Tour de France Femme. We don't know how she would have performed there, but she's shown that she can be on, you know, top of her game throughout a long season. So there will be pressure, but as Orla said, I think she has shown she can thrive in that kind of environment.
And I guess if you're going to change teams anyway, it was maybe a bigger risk to stay with Lidl Trek. She's been there for 6 years already. She just won the Giro d'Italia. So now is the time to capitalize on that. And there's clearly more money in the women's peloton now. I mean, it still doesn't compare anything like to the men's side of the sport. But now is the time to capitalize on your career. So I would say that arguably the greater risk might have been to stay at Lidl Trek.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, and this is Lionel again to tell you that this episode is also supported by LinkedIn Sales Navigator. Now, if you work in sales, you may be struggling to close deals at the moment, because business-to-business selling is tougher than ever in this current environment. And that's why LinkedIn Sales Navigator could be the tool you need to unlock the door to bigger and better deals. Because LinkedIn Sales Navigator is a sales intelligence platform that helps professional people effectively identify and engage with high-value potential customers, which in turn can help drive higher revenue and increase sales performance. Sales Navigator helps you target the right buyers. LinkedIn's platform of more than 1 billion members might make it feel like looking for a needle in a haystack, but Sales Navigator does all of the work for you, sorting out potential buyers, surfacing key indicators that might indicate that somebody is in the market for the goods or services that you're trying to sell, and then steering you in the right direction and establishing contact with people who may well be most likely to convert into customers. As I say, LinkedIn is a platform of more than 1 billion members, and Sales Navigator gives you the most up-to-date first-party data, enabling you to unlock conversations with the people that matter, basically the decision-makers in any given business. So right now, all of our listeners can try LinkedIn Sales Navigator and get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/win. That's linkedin.com/win for your 60-day free trial. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/win and get started.
Well, should we talk about Lidl Trek and about kind of the comings and goings there? Because obviously they're going to have, like I mentioned, Rhianna Marcus and Nefesha Black are kind of their sort of GC riders that are kind of coming in. But they also got a lot of support. They've got Anna Henderson coming from Visma Lisa Bike and Emma Norsgaard coming from Movistar. So they kind of become a bit of an unknown quantity to an extent, you know. Slight Nefesha Black obviously has been a super domestique, hasn't she, at SD Works, now finally being let off the leash and obviously joining Guy Raylini as well, another young GC rider. So, you know, there's a huge potential for a lot of some breakthrough results, I think, for both Guy Raylini and Nefesha Black in that kind of setup.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those teams which is, when you look at the roster for 2025, it's packed with talent. Although they've lost Longo Borghini, they've still got Elisa Balsamo. Lizzie Deignan, of course, will be riding her last season. And you mentioned Gaia Raiolini, of course, and Shirin Van Anroy as well, who was such a boon to Longo Borghini in the classic season. Those two kind of really played off each other so well. And that was Shirin Van Anroy's role in Longo Borghini's Flanders win was so important. So they've got the strength and depth. They can play the numbers game, which they played, well, we argued about the extent to which they played that well in the classics, but they clearly, you know, have that strength. And I think they'll need to play on that again, because I think the one thing lacking with Lidl Trek at the moment is that although they have some incredibly strong riders, apart from arguably Balsamo, they don't have anyone who's regularly won races or the biggest races in the last year or two. So they will need riders, their new signings like Emma Norsgaard, Nefesha Black, Anna Henderson, to kind of move to that next level, which I guess a lot of people think they've got the potential to. But so there will be question marks. Can Nefesha Black really prove herself as a genuine GC rider, which maybe she's been not had that opportunity enough at SD Works? Maybe this is her big opportunity. Maybe this will be her breakthrough year. Similarly, Emma Norsgaard, she's such a brilliant, brilliant rider, but she's kind of evolved from a sprinter to a classics rider. And, you know, can she find her niche? Can she really challenge in the classics? It's a really interesting team. The challenge for the management and for the riders will be to make the most of that potential and convert that strength and depth into wins.
I think it's a real chance to reset, really, for Lidl Trek, because we kind of have known what they're about for quite a long time now. And Elisa Longo Borghini and Lizzie Deignan, certainly the teams, the duo spearheading what that is and the teamwork, and they've been there for such a long time. And anyone else getting their opportunity, they've sort of been peppered throughout the season, really. But now we've got a chance for a reset, and Lizzie Deignan is in her final year, so she can have that year of sort of handing over the mantle and being a bit of a mentor as well as trying to get her own results. But if you look at some of the riders that we've been talking about there, Shirin Van Anroy is still only 22, Guy Raylini 23, Elisa Balsamo is still only 26, and they're amongst the most successful and exciting of that team that are moving forward. And I think it's a real chance now for the management and for the riders themselves to establish a new way of being. You know, where what is the hierarchy? Where do we give our opportunities? How does this team work well together? And so I'm excited to see what that produces, because while I think we have known what to expect, and they've always been one of these teams, certainly with Elisa and Guy Arellini working together as well, that have always attacked, and we've wondered sometimes at that strategy and whether or not that's been effective, but they've always been willing to throw themselves in the mix. What is the new DNA of the team? You know, what does it remain pretty much what it's been before? Does it shake up a little bit? Do we have new opportunities and new personalities that will thrive in a slightly adjusted setup? I think it's going to be really interesting to watch.
Yeah, I mean, we've spoken quite a lot about kind of the teams that we see a lot of potential excitement coming from next season. But, you know, how about the teams that we think maybe have a little bit more to do, or maybe have lost out in the transfer market, you know, as we see it so far? Denny, do you have any teams or names on your list of moves that you think won't work out, or, you know, teams that need to hit the late minute transfers, try and find someone through university clearing or something?
Well, we have noticed that Roland haven't confirmed any riders for next season so far, so which is, you know, highly unusual this late in the season. We're not clear what's happening there. Ollie, you pointed out when we were talking earlier that, of course, they have, or Rose, maybe it was you, sorry, but they have registered anyway to become a Women's World Tour team for 2025, so the paperwork's in. We just need to know whether they have any riders, so that's a huge question mark. I think another team that will be feeling a bit concerned next year is potentially Saratizit, because just after we recorded the last show, the announcement came that arguably their biggest rider and one of the most exciting riders around, Cedrin Kerbol, who took that brilliant swashbuckling stage win in the Tour de France Femme this season, is moving to EF Education. Apparently she got out of the contract at Saratizit because Saratizit had been late in submitting their paperwork, and there was a clause in her contract which would let her go. So that's a big, big loss for a team that doesn't really have a lot of kind of star riders. And she really did kind of, I guess, shine a light for that team last season and the last couple of seasons. And it's a big, big win for EF Education. And I guess the other thing to say in all this transfer mix is, of course, is that the end of 2025 will be another kind of promotion and relegation situation for the Women's World Tour. So a lot of transfers going on at the moment are important for that promotion and relegation race. You have got teams like EF Education, Laborel Kutcher and others who will be looking to step up to World Tour team status. And of course, the more points they bag, the more chance they have of being promoted. So that's another consideration for teams like Roland and Saratizit, who are kind of losing some of their bigger riders.
Saratizit also, you know, what Cedrin Kerbol was one of eight riders who are leaving, and you know, all of the other riders are kind of the mainstays of their Tour de France squad, the likes of Arzufi, Asensio, Martelac, Martina Fidanza. You know, they're all their key riders that are all going. So it really leaves them sort of a bit in limbo, doesn't it, at this point. Orla, what did you see as the teams that could do a bit more?
Well, I mean, I was going to say, pass a quick comment on SD Works, but I don't think it's really worth it, but I'm going to do it anyway, obviously. but just because they've been so dominant for such a long time, I think this is potentially the season where that, and again, they weren't dominant across the Grand Tours last year, but they still felt like the super team. I feel like this is the season where we finally dismantle the super team status of SD Works, really. I'd be surprised if it's any other way. Even though we do have Anna van der Breggen, even though we do have Lotta, and even though we do have Lorena Vibus, obviously. But they do. It's not the days of old where we had a potential Ashley Moulman, Passio, and we had the Damien, and we had these multiple cards to play across every single bike race. They're going to have to be more selective, and they could still be selective with even just Lotta and Lorena and still pick up pretty much everything going. They very much could do. However, they don't have that ridiculous strength and depth next season that they've had in seasons gone by, which is a wonderful thing for the rest of the peloton. And I don't think it's maybe necessarily going to damage them too much ultimately, because they had too many ambitions to juggle. But I'm a bit curious, I think, about DSM,
Sorry, my future self here, just interrupting Orla with a little revision for this upcoming section on Team DSM Firmenich. At the time of recording, they had only signed two young riders, but since then, Team DSM has signed Marta Cavalli on a three-year deal. Cavalli is a former Flèche Wallonne and Amstel Gold Race champion, so of course bolsters their classics campaign, and has shown huge promise in stage racing, finishing second overall to Annemiek van Vleuten at the Giro in 2022. She is, however, still only 26 years old and has endured two injury-plagued seasons, racing only 5 days this year, so comes to the team untested on recent form. I'll hand you back to Orla.
They've only brought in two very young riders. We've got the 18-year-old Ella Hermans and 20-year-old Mara Roldan. And if you look at their roster for next year, it's still incredible. We still have Rachele Barbieri, Pfeiffer Giorgi, of course, Megan Yastra, we've got Charlotta Cole, arguably the only rider in a flat sprint who can still get Lorena Vivas time in, time out.
And they're so young, aren't they? I mean, you said all about the 18-year-old, 20-year-old coming in, but the oldest rider on their team next year is 27. That, you know, that's the oldest.
Esme Peperkamp.
So that's absolutely kind of, insane. But then, you know, it's also, you know, are they just becoming more of a development squad? You know, is the plan more long-term? They're obviously one of the teams that have kind of got the most stability and has been on the scene for the longest. They can have that kind of long-term projection in a way that some of perhaps the smaller teams with sponsors going in and out, they, you know, they have to get the results.
Yeah.
Their kind of whole, you know, reason for existing was kind of mainly built around Juliette Labousse and what she could do in the Grand Tours. Obviously, they still have Pfeiffer Giorgi, and of course we were delighted to see that she's back on her bike after that crash that she had in the Tour de France Femme, where she broke her hand, fractured her neck, and thankfully she's now back out riding, which is great to see. But it might be an opportunity for someone like Pfeiffer Giorgi or Josie Nelson, Denny, mightn't it, at DSM, kind of not having that, you know, kind of the split focuses, you know, having lots of riders, well, having Pfeiffer Giorgi working for Juliette Labousse all the time. Might it mean that Pfeiffer's got a bit more room to get kind of classics wins and wins in those races that she does so well?
You'd hope so, wouldn't you? I mean, that's something we've all been waiting to see, haven't we? Because Pfeiffer is one of those riders, not just because she's British, but because she has shown at Paris-Roubaix, for example, this year, just what a brilliant classics rider she is and can be. And we've always felt that she hasn't really had the opportunity to be an out-and-out leader at that team because she has worked so diligently in the service of Charlotte Cole. She's, you know, such a great team player. But yeah, hopefully this will mean more opportunities for her. And as you say, I mean, I guess it's one of those teams that has always been very good at developing riders. It has always taken on younger riders. And you know, we have seen riders come through the ranks in that team. And I'm sure we will continue to see riders kind of go on to bigger and better things. But it does leave a big question mark about their ability to kind of really challenge beyond Charlotte Cole and Pfeiffer Giorgi. I guess the other thing to say there is that that is a team that has traditionally stuck to the plan, hasn't it? They have a plan and they feel they have to rigidly stick to that. And will they show more flexibility with riders like Pfeiffer Giorgi? Will they be willing to say, okay, you can have a free role today. Don't worry about riding solely for Charlotte Cole. I feel like they might need to think a bit more flexibly if they're going to make the most of some of those riders.
Yeah, well, you know, talking of teams that kind of bringing on young riders and kind of, taking a bit of gamble like that, I do want to, take a moment to talk about Kat Ferguson moving to Movistar. I know, Denny, you've been following her career from a British continental standpoint very closely, but I mean, she's a huge talent, isn't she? Coming through the junior ranks, actually a lot like Pfeiffer Giorgi did, kind of so dominant in the junior races. And obviously, because we don't have that under 23 kind of level, we don't have those committed development teams on the women's side. The junior riders do have to come straight into the deep end, don't they? And obviously joining Movistar, it's a move that we knew that was happening for a very long time. But, you know, we'll finally see, when she's finally at Movistar officially from next year, we'll see what she can do, won't we?
Yeah, I mean, we've already seen what she can do. And she has probably been the most hyped British junior since Tom Pidcock, I'd say, in both men's and women's racing. Probably,
which was absolutely ages ago, wasn't it?
It does feel like a while
if you can remember who that guy was.
But I mean, you know, he was winning everything as a junior in Britain and you know, winning world cyclocross championships and everything else. Kat Ferguson, her first race as a junior, beginning of 2023, lined up against the best British domestic riders, won that race, her first open race on an open road, won it against some of the finest, and just didn't stop winning last year and has continued that on this year, not just domestically, but on the international stage too. And of course, she had that double world championships win in the time trial and the road race on the road this year. But I think more than that, what has been so impressive about Kat Ferguson is the fact that there is so much hype around her. There must be huge expectation on her shoulders, and yet she continues to win. And we have seen lots of riders do well at the junior level and then maybe not go on to obscurity, but have, you know, struggled when they've made the step up. But what was most impressive about Kat Ferguson this year was the fact that she was winning when she joined Movistar. It only took her three races to win. She won a stage at the AG Tour de la Samoie in Belgium, which is only a 2.2 race, but nevertheless, mighty impressive for your third race in as still riding as a junior. But then after her Worlds wins, she went on to win Banche Pour Dames, which is a much bigger race, a 1.1 race, a huge result. When you remember that she's still just a junior, she beat riders like Charlotte Kuhl and Anina Attasalo in that race. So she was already taking big, big scalps. So yeah, she's going to be a rider to watch next season. And if she can keep her head, you know, can keep grounded, then I think we can see a lot from her quite soon.
Yeah, she wasn't off the podium, was she, until September when she came seventh in the Stuttgart GP, which is a real blot on her blot on her record. And obviously joining Marlon Reusser at Movistar as well, which, you know, is a huge transfer that we haven't really spoken about.
I feel like as well, because Denny, you've been championing her for quite some time, and rightly so. It is easy to forget she is 18. Mm. She's 18 years of age. And that Banche Mé Banche victory that you referenced, for me, that was one of the most impressive, because you can only beat the field in front of you. But as you say, to beat the likes of Charlotte Kuhl, I'm sorry, it's ridiculous, at the age of 18. Also, Emma Norsgaard in that race. I mean, the level of raw talent that must take is insane. So to think of how she's going to be shaped at Movistar is really, really exciting. And also to go full circle back to what we started the podcast talking about in terms of Anna van der Breggen coming back into the sport. When we talk about where we are with women's cycling right now, it feels like yesterday that we were talking about riders constantly having to have an extra job or continuing their university education and professional, in inverted commas, bike racing having to be something that they did on the side. Now to have someone like Kat Ferguson coming through at the age of 18, going straight into the Women's World Tour and already beating the likes of Charlotte Kuhl, who is a world beater in her own right, I think that's really, really exciting, not just for Kat, but also the state of women's racing. And it shows that we're in a good place right now.
Yeah, really encouraging. And as you say, Marlon Reusser as well is another a big switch. Obviously, she's had a very difficult year, hasn't she, this year with, or she pulled out of a race last year, didn't she, ahead of the time trial at the Worlds through mental health issues, and had kind of other health issues this year. But a rider with huge, huge potential, again, often kind of ridden in the service of the bigger stars at SD Works. And you know, she's won the Tour de Suisse before. She's got she could become a really, really good GC rider in her own right. So again, Movistar feels like an interesting proposition at the moment, doesn't it? Because it's got those riders that have so much potential, and it's about, you know, how they manage them, what opportunities they give them, and how much pressure they put on them this year. But that is another team where, since Annemiek van Vleuten left, I think they didn't feel lost this year, but they haven't had an obvious leader. So it'll be interesting to see whether, I mean, not to say they haven't had leaders, Leanna Lippert and others are obviously brilliant riders, but what I mean is they haven't had that big star to rally around. So it'll be interesting to see whether they can find their way a bit more in 2025.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by MAP.
These days, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make all kinds of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs in towns and cities across the country. And jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20. American Giant makes great clothing, sweatshirts, jeans, and more right here in the U.S. Visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.
Well, it's now time for our mini feature. And this month we're talking about Dutch cycling, women's Dutch cycling. You know, why is it so good? You know, why have they been so dominant for so long? And so me and Denny, when we were at the Tour de France, we thought we'd canvass a few opinions from some Dutchies and some non-Dutchies about that, why that was. Let's have a listen.
Because we're Dutch. Because we're like we grow up like very bold and independent little girls, and we think we can rule the world. No, I'm joking, but I think it has something to do with we're a very emancipated country. Like, there are more countries, like the Netherlands, of course, that have a lot of opportunities for girls, but I think we are raised with the attitude that we can do everything we want.
That was former Dutch national champion Iris Slappendel, who raced at the elite level from 2004 to 2016.
We have that attitude that we don't really care. I have had many teammates from different countries like Switzerland or Germany or Belgium, and they're way more passive. And I think that's not really in our DNA. We're a bit like, yeah, we know what we want and we're going after it.
Rotterdam hosted this year's Tour de France Femme Grand Départ, a fitting start considering the close connection the nation has enjoyed with the race. Dutch riders have won almost 60% of Tour de France Femme stages since the race's return in 2022. But their supremacy goes back much further than that. The dominance of the likes of Leontien van Morsel in the 90s gave way to the dominance of the likes of Marianne Vos and the Rabobank team in the noughties, which gave way to the dominance of the likes of Anna van der Breggen and Annemiek van Vleuten in more recent years. So what do the Dutch riders themselves make of it? Here's three-time Tour de France Femme stage winner Lorena Wiebes.
Well, I have not really a deep. Yeah, of course, the Netherlands is. You learn to bike really quick when you are younger. We do a lot of things on the bike, like to school and to work and everything. Yeah, for the rest, I don't know. But maybe also because in the past we had a lot of successful Dutch riders, so it keeps. Yeah, the little ones motivated to go there.
Was there anybody you looked up to when you were younger?
Well, of course, Marianne Vos was the one, really outstanding when I was younger, and still she is. So, yeah.
And here's former European champion Misha Bredevold.
I mean, we're just born on bikes, you know. So everybody's riding their bikes. So yeah, obviously, a large percentage of your population ride their bike, then there will come be some talented ones, I guess.
Okay, so you just think it's a natural consequence of lots of people riding bikes?
Yeah, I mean, I was just discussing this at home. I mean, it's also you influence each other, you know. As the level increases, you get better, and so we all make each other better because there's just so many good riders.
Perhaps the people who understand the strengths of the Dutch riders best are the riders that are trying to overcome them. British racer Lizzie Dynan spent six of her most prolific years at Dutch juggernaut Bols Dolmans, now Team SD Works, before joining Trek in 2019.
Yeah, absolutely. Loads of reasons. I mean, you can't be what you can't see, and the Dutch have had role models in women's cycling for years and years. I think it's only now in Britain that you see that we have a generation of women coming through, because we've missed, although we had people like Nicole Cook, Emma Pooley, they never got the exposure they deserved. And I think Holland has always been a step ahead in that. You know, they had Leontine van Morsel, she's a household name. So a role model plays a big part in it. Infrastructure, safe to cycle. Races, I mean, they have so many more races, local races. And yeah, they're just good, aren't they? Yeah.
Let's also hear from British rider Becky Story, who is in her second season with Dutch outfit Team DSM Firmenich.
I think, yeah, I mean, it's crazy their dominance, but I think it's like one of those things that success breeds success. You know, when you have so many strong women to idolise, it's like you achieve that, you believe that you can achieve the same. And being on a Dutch team, I know like how much of perfectionists that we are. They really go to every single detail, and I think that ultimately, yeah, breeds success.
The tide does seem to be turning now, though. Riders from 16 different countries have taken victories in the Women's World Tour races this season. Other nations are certainly closing the gap. Here's Iris again.
Of course, we have a super good structure. And I think now other countries are catching up. But like in the time I was young, there we had so many opportunities to race. We had a national federation that supported us with training camps, with equipment. Now, of course, all the teams are catching up. And riders have very similar facilities. But I think, yeah, that the fact that you can race from a young age, have with good competition with girls and boys, and then you have a good like national system. And we all brought each other to a higher level. And I think that's something that you still see now, that there is this almost internal competition to be able to make it to World Championships or Olympic Games is so tough already. That I think that's one of the reasons. But I think also that's why now you see other countries are catching up, like Italy, for example. The UK is really strong at the moment. So they also have this competition, and that helps. Yeah.
Well, we heard there, didn't we, a huge amount of reason about why Dutch cycling is so good. And of course, we experienced that firsthand, Denny, didn't we, out at the tour. So many huge crowds, and also just all of the bike infrastructure, of course, there. Just, you know, as part of, as Orla will know very well, you know, just part of everyday life. You almost actually broke your ankle, didn't you, jumping between tram lines and bike paths. Yeah. In Rotterdam. But, you know, the appetite for cycling is so huge there.
It is huge. It is huge. And of course, we were recording that after the Dutch had won the first four stages of the Tour de France Femme. Damie Vollering was in yellow and it looked like a dead cert. She was going to win. Of course, then everything changed, didn't it? And we went from Dutch domination four stage wins from other countries. And of course, Kasia Niewiadoma winning the race from Poland, of course. So and I think that felt like a symbolic change, really, because I think it, whilst the Dutch will, I'm sure, continue to be a huge, huge force in women's cycling for many years to come because of the infrastructure, because of the culture. But it's clear that there are other countries now who are managing to get their riders to the very top, and talked about many of those riders today in our, you know, transfer look. It isn't just the Dutch riders now that are challenging, both at the GC level, but, you know, across the piece. So I think things do feel like they're changing. And the other symbolic thing for me is the fact that we've got Damie Vollering, arguably the biggest star in women's cycling, going to a French team. And that feels like a real shift in power. FDJ Suez clearly have a lot of resources, and Orla mentioned it earlier. You know, we're almost seeing kind of more resources now being put into other teams and other countries, the Dutch cycling heartland, which I think is brilliant, because I think that will help lift up the rest of, other talent in other countries.
Yeah, FDJ Suez was so kind of
Keane, the general manager, Stephen Delcourt, was also so keen to mention how, you know, it's a French team and French identity, although their biggest rider is Demi Vollering there, but obviously they've got Evita Musique and Juliette Labousse. And he was kind of so keen in this influx of money that's going into the team that it is, that it has a, you know, a French identity, and, you know, they're going to try and win the biggest race in the world, which is a French race. You know, it's that kind of national pride is an important thing that, you know, is going to help kind of rival the Dutch dominance that has been. But, you know, Orla, obviously you live over in Amsterdam and you've lived in lots of different places in the world. And how different is it culturally, you know, raising children in that culture? Can you see how, you know, they raise so many champions over there in a way that that hasn't been the case elsewhere?
The thing is, right, I can and I can't. It's a really curious thing because obviously everybody here rides their bike. That's a given. We don't own a car. We get around by bike everywhere. So bike riding is a very common thing. My eldest will ride her bike to school. She rides to hockey, like a 10-kilometer loop. She's only just turned 10. My son rides his bike whenever he can because he loves it. But there's a real distinction in the Netherlands between riding for transport, which is just as natural as breathing almost, and competitive racing. And there's a massive gulf really culturally between the two here, because most people in the Netherlands will not consider themselves to be cyclists at all. Like, I can't get that across enough. They consider themselves to just move around. They're just people who move around on bicycles. But as a professional competitive sport, it's still seen as a sport. And for example, hockey is a much bigger competitive sport in the Netherlands, field hockey, than cycling is. Now, it's a much easier transition here, and bike skills are a given because, you know, kids from the age of 6 are riding to school, and so you're used to being able to handle your bike in certain situations. But it's still a very commuting, sedate, genteel kind of bike riding. And it is easier because we do have more competition. So for example, like there's this little crit that my daughter did when she was maybe 8 around the Olympic Stadium, and it was like a 1K loop and you did a couple of laps, and there was something for every age group, and it's really easy to enter into any kind of competition. She's already done like a BMX summer camp and that kind of thing. It's, you know, the pathway into getting into sport, into cycling as a sport that you do for fun, is really easy. But the reason I say it's not necessarily a given that that would turn into competitive cycling is because since I've moved here, I've had the same question as everybody else. Why are the Dutch so strong? Because I don't know any of my friendship group whose kids compete in a cycling club or are part of a cycling club. They all ride their bikes, but that doesn't translate into competitive cycling. And so I've always felt like it shouldn't be the difference. Like, the infrastructure and kids riding their bikes to school should not be what makes a difference at the top level, unless the rest of the professional landscape isn't quite there yet. And so if the Dutch are punching so strongly, it always said to me, well, it's because we don't have a strength and depth across the professional field, because it's not like we're all riding our bikes competitively. So now for the Dutch not to be quite as dominant says to me, well, this is more where we should be, that it should be that professionally everyone else is able to compensate for the fact that they don't ride their bikes as kids, because it's a different game. You know, riding your bike every day is a different game to competing professionally. And so I feel like the Dutch will continue to be incredibly strong because, like I say, it's not a weird thing to ride your bike. It's very natural. It's very normal. We also obviously don't have mountains or hills beyond bridges over here. However, we do have incredibly, ridiculously horrific, horrible weather conditions. And because of the flat land, we don't have anything to break up the crosswind, the headwind, which whatever direction you ride in, the wind is in your face. So it makes for very strong, athletic people. And also, sorry, as a final thing to say on this, because I'm wanging on about it, but girls here in particular, through their teen years, tend to stay sporty, which I think is another thing that's probably quite overlooked. Because they ride their bikes everywhere, they don't see being sporty and being active as something that is inconducive with being a teen. It's still just something you do. You're not spending, you know, 40 minutes in the bathroom of a morning doing your hair and your makeup perfectly to go to school because it's utterly pointless because you're about to ride to school in the wind and the rain. And so I think maybe it's more natural then for girls to keep competing. They are very athletic. They are very sporty in that way. But like I say, at the elite level, that should have evened itself out because we're only getting the people who've made it as far as the elites, and it shouldn't make so much of a difference, I feel. So now the fact that the Dutch aren't dominating can only be a good thing because it means that the rest of the sport is becoming more professional. And in the other countries where we're seeing success, the trend will reverse its way back down again. So in Poland, we're going to see little girls now thinking of riding their bikes as a sport. You know, we're going to see French girls, because, you know, the French have great infrastructure and a good culture of cycling as well. But hopefully, if we see the likes of Pauline, you know, smashing it next year for Visma, we're going to see young girls in France as well thinking, well, that's maybe a sport that I want to get into. So, yeah, it's a really curious cultural study, really. And as ever, there's no one simple single answer to anything.
That inspiration is so important, isn't it? And, we did hear in the feature that riders saying, you know, we have had, you know, Marianne Vos has been at the top of the game for so long that seeing that effect of bringing other riders through and wanting to be like Marianne Vos. And, you know, we've heard about the Lotte Kopecky effect in Belgium where suddenly, you know, it's kind of the sign-ups for being a junior race has gone up tenfold. But we should actually, talking about kind of inspiration, a rider that we haven't actually spoken about a transfer we should have a quick word on, is Cecilia Ludwig. Obviously, she has got such a huge profile in terms of bringing fans to the sport, bringing attention to the sport with her kind of passionate interviews, passionate riding. But she's moving from FDJ and she's going to Canyon-SRAM, isn't she, next year? So she'll be kind of part of that to support Kasia Niewiadoma's defence of her Tour de France FAM title. What do we make of that move, Orla, at Canyon-SRAM?
I find it really interesting, this one, because I think Cecily probably could have gone anywhere, really. And I wouldn't have been surprised if she'd stayed at FDJ with Damie coming in. The ways that they maybe could have complemented each other, the different cards that they could have been able to play in each other's benefit. But we've known that, or we now know that Damie's transfer was decided back in April. So Cecily leaving FDJ was in the full knowledge that Damie was coming in. I am also curious because I find her and Kasia very similar riders with very similar attributes. So I wonder how they're going to be able to support each other. And Kasia has said that they will be able to have that decoy option. And maybe the fact that they have similar strengths is a good thing. I think it's going to be just really interesting to see how it pans out. And I think as well to see what Cecily will be able to do in that team will be exciting for her. I don't think she'll be going in thinking I'm just going to be supporting Kasia at all. Cecily is someone who loves to win, obviously, and I'll be curious to see how she can get on under Magnus Backsted's tutelage as well, because I feel like his arrival at Canyon arguably made quite the difference in terms of them going from a frustratingly wonderful team full of potential to one that was finally delivering the wins. So what he'll be able to get out of her as well, I think, will be really exciting.
Bit of a boon also for Canyon-SRAM to keep Kasia Niewiadoma, wasn't it? Because at one point we thought that she was going to leave Denny. We thought that she was bound to look elsewhere, but, you know, that she's had a fantastic season since she's kind of signed the contract to stay.
Yeah, I mean, I nearly picked her as my first choice because although she's not a transfer as such, actually signing a new contract with Canyon-SRAM was a big, big moment for that team, particularly now she's a Tour de France winner. But she has been such a talisman, hasn't she, for that team over the years. And she's you can't really imagine her on another team. But to keep her was a big boon. It's interesting that they've lost Elise Chabet, which will be a bit of a loss for that team. But they've got Cecily Uttrup-Ludwig. They've also gained Chiara Consonni, who's one of those sprinters that is probably in that tier just below Lorena Wiebes and Charlotte Kuhl. She's another rider that's got a lot of potential and could really thrive in a team like that. I think what I've enjoyed about that team over the last couple of years is they have been willing to be quite aggressive in the way they've raced, and they've also been willing to give younger riders an opportunity. They've got another rider joining them from their Canyon-SRAM generation team, so they've got a really nice pathway and pipeline there. So yeah, hopefully it'll be a continuation of what we've seen for that team over the last couple of years, where they've really seemed to have grown and found their place. I think arguably, apart from Kasia Niewiadoma's Flèche Wallonne win, though, they seemed a bit underpowered in the classics. And so it'd be interesting to see whether the new transfers actually make them more of a player when it comes to the early season classics.
And obviously talking about cycling, moving out of the heartlands, moving away from the Netherlands, some news to come out of the Tashkent City Women's team. I know it's both your favourite team. Denny, you were obviously, you know, you spoke to the team quite a lot when we were at the tour, and we have actually got some good news, haven't we, about transfer from then?
Yeah, I mean, well, I guess the sad news for most of the team is that the team's closing down, or has closed down now. But Janina Kuskova, who, of course, we interviewed on stage 7, I think it was, of the Tour de France Femme, she'd cut such a lonely figure during that race, hadn't she, Rose? And we kept seeing her kind of alone. And she gave a really revealing interview where she'd explained that she was the only rider left on their team because all the others had to abandon. She was in the peloton on her own. She hadn't had the greatest of receptions from the rest of the peloton, she said. But she battled on to finish that race. Clearly a talented rider, finished the Giro as well last year. And she was desperately hoping to find a team. And she's been signed by Laborel Kutcher for next season. So they're hoping to move up to this new pro team tier, the second division in women's cycling. So that's a big move for her. Cynically speaking, it will also help Laurel Kutcher in their chase for points when it comes to promotion next season, because, of course, she comes with a lot of UCI points, having done quite well in Uzbekistan road championships. But I think it is deserving. She is clearly a rider that has battled through a lot to get to where she's got to now, and to earn a pro contract, I think is wholly on merit. You know, she's shown by finishing the Giro and the Tour against enormous adversity that she's a rider that's fully deserving of being in the pro peloton.
Well, I think that's some good news to end on anyway. And what a hugely great way to set up next year, and the dynamics that are just such a big unknown, aren't they, for us with all of these transfers coming up. It's going to be such a thrilling season. But I'm going to, you know, let both of you go. And, Denny, you're going to be back for the Christmas quiz, aren't you? So I hope, you know, that, well, we're going to be without Orla for the Christmas quiz this time. So you might have a bigger chance of winning, or at least coming out feeling a little bit less bruised, at least.
Well, I won't be up against Anna van der Breggen, will I? Yeah, I won't be up against Anna van der Breggen, which is a relief. I'm eager to hear who I will be up against in your kind of, you know, metaphors, rider comparisons.
Oh, yes.
You know, how you label the competitor, who will remain unnamed for now.
Yeah, well, I know. I've got to keep some... It's like me and Orla did at the end of the last episode. Got to keep a bit of a juicy secret, don't we?
You're like Santa. You've got a lot of presents in your sack, but you can't give them out just yet.
And do you think you're on the naughty list or the nice list, Orla?
Definitely naughty.
It's the better list to be on, isn't it?
Fun over here.
But Orla, well, thank you very much for joining us on this bumper episode. And, have a Merry Christmas.
Same to you both as well. I'm sorry to be missing it. I should maybe do a little bit of carol singing now to make sure that you're not left deprived for the festive season.
Oh, okay.
But I won't.
Yes.
I won't. That was my gift to you. I'll spare you my singing.
Send in a recording, Orla, so we can...
Do you know what? I just might. My daughter is learning, you know that...
Oh, my... Yes.
On the piano. So I'm going to get her to send a little version of that in, shall we?
That'd be lovely.
That's a real earworm. That must just go round and round.
Oh, it's gorgeous. I love it. I love it. It's one of my favourites. Home Alone, wasn't that? Wasn't that in Home Alone?
I don't know what it's in, actually. But it's kind of, I like it because it's great, but it's also slightly ominous, isn't it?
Exactly.
It's kind of slightly stressful.
A little bit
dark,
but twinkly all the same, you know?
Yeah.
I love it. Like, you never quite know what the night holds in store. When that song comes on, I sound like I'm gone out to that music. I mean, when it comes on in the movie, it's always nighttime. You never know where the storyline's going to go. That's my level of rock and roll sitting in the sofa with some popcorn.
Well, I'm looking forward to what the Chenoui family is going to provide us with in terms of musical accompaniment now. You've really set it up, Orla.
Right, I'll do that. I'll do that. She'll love that. We'll get that sent in.
Love to hear it. Well, thank you very much both for joining me. Thank you, Denny.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you, Orla.
Thank you both.
And thank you, listeners.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
This country was built on a distinctly American work ethic. But today, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and diminished our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make a variety of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more. All made right here in the USA, from growing the cotton and adding the final touches. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs for seamsters, cutters, and factory workers in towns and cities across the United States. And it's about more than an income. Jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.